Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, also at 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with my global roster of fund managers, analysts, and journalists on the ground and in major financial centers, we examine emerging and frontier market investing, try to clear up some of the misconceptions about these attractive asset classes, and suggest courses of action that you, the listener, can take to actually benefit from them. I spent most of my professional career analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and ones that are maybe a little less promising. By emerging markets, of course, we mean the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, along with such major countries as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. And today I'll have a report on the effect of the Russia-Ukraine crisis on Russian equities, including a quick investment analysis from that well-known investment source, the White House Press Secretary, Jay Carney. By frontier markets, we mean, in general, less developed emerging markets like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Slovenia, Slovakia, and Botswana. And today we'll have reports on Ethiopia, Colombia, and Argentina, which was moved from emerging to frontier market status a few years ago, and Qatar, which is moving up from frontier to emerging market status in May this year. First, let's look at Russia. As the Olympic celebrations in Sochi died down, the crisis between Russia and Ukraine heated up. Pro-Russian militia took control of the Parliament of Crimea. A pro-Russian faction was declared the government of Crimea and promptly requested assistance from Russia, and troops with insignias removed but using Russian vehicles moved in quickly to take over the Crimea. And a referendum on leaving the Ukraine was held on March 16th, which showed 97% of the voters in favor. On March the 18th, Russia formally joined with Crimea when Mr. Putin signed the treaty. I won't say annexing the peninsula, joining with the peninsula. So, I have independent Russian analyst James Beadle on the line from Monaco. He frequently travels to Russia most recently last week and keeps in touch with the equity action there. Now, Jay Carney, better known as the White House press secretary, suggested last week investors should avoid Russian equities unless they were, quote, going short. Would you agree with that view? And quite frankly, do you think it's appropriate that U.S. officials are actually giving investment advice on a market like Russia, James?
Thank you, Gavin, and thanks for having me on the show once again. With regard to these comments by public officials, I think it's obviously a little bit out of place. It's quite unusual, actually, for U.S. officials to make comments like this. It's the kind of behavior that actually I'm used to seeing from less professional Russian politicians. So it's very disappointing to hear this kind of comment coming from a Russian official. And perhaps not completely accurate. I definitely wouldn't be recommending your listeners to go out and buy Russian ETFs or to Russian to buying Russian equities at this stage. Obviously, they've been extremely volatile over the last few weeks since these events began to transpire. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that everything is going to be going down and everything is going to be going up. I think that we can start to look at the market then from a more realistic perspective on a company-by-company basis. So there are some companies in the Russian equity universe, like Lukoil, which we talked about last time on the show, which is holding its price reasonably well in the downturn and benefiting a lot from the cheaper ruble. Whereas there are other companies perhaps exposed to the domestic market, which are a little bit less secure and will perhaps suffer from capital flowing out of Russia in a more difficult economic situation in Russia. So no, I don't agree with the comment, and I find the comment rather inappropriate.
Well, James, just to remind our listeners, how far has the Russian index fallen so far this year? It's depending on which index you're looking at, but I think the MICEX is off more than 10%. Is that right?
Yeah, so last time I checked it, it was around 15% down for the year, but obviously it's very volatile, and I haven't had a chance to look at it today to see how it's moved. It has stabilized a little bit in the last week. And in fact, what's really interesting is that there are only really two very big down days, and One of them was the day when Russia first moved into Crimea, and the second one was the day when the Friday before the referendum in Crimea. So if you bought on either of those 2 days, actually you're making quite good money in the Russian market this year. And aside from that, it's been sort of staggering around a little bit. So it's not really not a one-way trade. And as I think the news flow maybe will start to quieten down a little bit, perhaps we'll see a bit more stability in the market. And then people will start to talk about whether or not the valuation is interesting again.
One other factor investors from outside Russia have to consider, obviously, James, is the currency. The ruble's down around 7 to 8%, and the rating agency is looking at downgrading. How serious do you feel that threat is, and do you think that weakness in the ruble might continue?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the biggest events that we've seen in the few weeks since we were last talking about what was happening out there. Both Fitch and S&P announcing that they're putting Russia's credit rating under review. And I think if you look at the pricing of Russian debt, it's already quite significantly impacted. I'm reflecting a credit rating lower than Russia is currently officially holding. So perhaps to some extent that is already in the market. My personal feeling really is that the ruble has oversold on this, and considering the price of oil stays up, I would not expect the ruble to collapse much more. And therefore I see some potential stabilization in the ruble. And certainly the Russian bond market with 10-year bonds paying around 10% is perhaps an interesting diversification for some people. Traditionally, it's been easier to make money in Russian debt than it has in Russian equity. After the default in 1998, Russians have become much more reliable at paying back their bonds than they have been at honoring dividend payments or managing companies in ways that suited minority shareholders. So there's certainly some pockets of attractive interest in the Russian market, despite what's going on.
Would it be fair to say, apropos of the point you just made about Russia's repayment on its debt has been much more reliable in the last 15 years, despite the downgrades by the rating agencies to, or at least putting it on negative outlook, there's no real chance that Russia is going to default on its sovereign debt?
No, that's certainly something I would strongly agree with. I mean, to be honest, Russia could today go out and pay off all of its sovereign debt. This is not a country like the US, which has trillions and trillions of dollars of outstanding debt which it needs to pay off, and which is struggling to generate enough tax income to make its interest payments. Russia is essentially an end-net creditor to the world, and so the risk of default is very, very low. We're seeing selling out of bonds more from a sentiment perspective rather than a fundamental perspective. And, of course, that makes an interesting potential return to people.
So the economic sanctions that the Western powers have imposed on some of Mr. Putin's closest associates and Bank Russia, which is supposed to be the house bank for Mr. Putin and his allies, they don't appear to have made a great deal of effect in altering Mr. Putin's behavior. Is there any real negative impact potentially hitting Russia or Russian business as a result of these sanctions and asset freezes?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the sanctions are positive from the perspective that I think they do damage Putin's credibility inside the country, so they have some concept of effectiveness there. At the same time, they don't damage the broader economy. And we don't alienate the Russian population, which is very good. But I think one thing that isn't really making the media headlines is the fact that Western politicians certainly understand that the market is the best form of sanctioning out there. And I'm sure that Western companies doing business in Russia are going to be much more careful about investing there over the next period. And they're certainly relying on Russians to continue taking money out of the country. And definitely the Russian economy will not be performing as a result of this as it was performing before it. And so the upside is much less than it was before, relative to the beginning of the year. Sanctions themselves, you know, it's an interesting, complicated area, and I think that the market will do some sanctioning itself. But as I said, that doesn't mean that you can't find some interesting investment opportunities in the meantime.
Indeed. And I know that you'd mentioned both this time and the previous time we were speaking that maybe those exporters therefore going to be beneficiaries of the weaker ruble might be the area to be looking at. Apart from potential knock-on effects of sanctions, though, are there any other risks that you see from your visits there that maybe aren't making the headlines that could be an unpleasant surprise to people looking to invest in Russia?
I can't say so particularly. I think, you know, what Russia did in the 1990s was it had this big crash in the oil price, which brought the ruble very weak, and then the oil price rebounded. So with a weaker ruble, the Russian economy itself should stabilize. I think that the Western authorities are making a very good effort to explain to the Russian government that going any further with expansive geographic policies would be a mistake, and it would lead to a dramatic change in the level of sanctioning. So I don't think we'll see an acceleration of the conflict. I think we'll rather see it freezing. And as it freezes, then the potential to earn money is there. As I've said, I don't think you should rush into companies which are heavily exposed to the Russian economy, because it will go through some period of economic struggle during this process of ruble devaluation. So I would avoid the retail companies. I'm more cautious than I have been in the past about the telecom companies, even though they're getting cheaper now. Stick to the companies which are exporting strongly, and they'll benefit from the ruble, and I think they pay decent dividends. And if you can make your purchase decisions on the right days, then the opportunity for upside is still significant.
So just to finish up here, James, you think that with a 7 or 8% fall in the currency and a 15% fall in the index, so as a foreign investor, you're off around 20, 25%. That's most of the bad news already reflected, and that once things have settled down, and as you say, it's apparent Mr. Putin doesn't have any further territorial ambitions, if we can put it that way, then it might be worthwhile to edge back in cautiously to Russia.
Yeah, to do it very, very carefully. I mean, to be honest, we could see the equity index continuing to struggle because Gazprom and some of the banks are large components there, and they're probably not the best companies to be in. But it's definitely, I think we've seen the worst of the headlines here, and the potential to move in and start picking up value is definitely there if you do it on a careful and strategic basis.
Great. Thank you very much indeed, James. That's been very helpful in clarifying somewhat rapidly changing and confusing situation in Russia. I think it's fair enough to say that there might be some opportunities there, but there's no rush to step back in.
That's more or less the message. Thank you very much, Gavin. Have a great show.
Thanks so much, James. And that was Russian analyst James Beadle on the line from Monaco. Just before we go to the break, with the emerging market sell-off in January and February now seemingly coming to an end, is it time to be stepping back in there? Were you aware that frontier markets actually didn't sell off and are actually up slightly for the year? If you'd like some insight into the factors driving these moves in emerging and frontier markets, please subscribe to the current edition of our new publication, the EFMI newsletter. That's for Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. We try to answer some of these questions and suggest what might happen next. If you call 888-287-8229 or go to info@emergingfrontier.ca, you'll be able to get some information on the new publication. You can subscribe immediately at a discounted price of $94.99 by going to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter/buy. If you'd like more information, just call 888-287-8229. When we come back from the break, we'll be looking at Africa. Please stay with us.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Just before we go to our next guest, despite the fact that it's minus 12 in Toronto today and there's a big snowstorm battering the East Coast, summer is eventually going to arrive. And when it does, you might be enjoying a cold brew on your back deck. If you are drinking a beer made by one of our recommendations in the Emerging and Frontier Market Investing newsletter, you'd be drinking beer that from a company that gets almost 75% of its revenues from emerging and frontier markets, a great play on rising consumer incomes. Please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca for more information. And now to Africa consultant Aubrey Hurubi on the line from Washington, D.C. For 8 years ending in 2013, she was managing director of the Whitaker Group in Washington, a consulting firm for business in Africa. During those years, she spent about 70% of her time there, now continues traveling there several times a year. When we last spoke, she was explaining the outlook for Kenya. We touched briefly on Ethiopia. Today, we're going to go further with Ethiopia and its investment potential. Welcome back to the program, Aubrey.
Thanks, Gavin. It's such a pleasure.
Now, we did touch on Ethiopia briefly, and you were quite enthusiastic about it. Why is Ethiopia a better investment destination than somewhere like Kenya, which has very much been the focus of most investors' interest in sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, Gavin, Ethiopia has easily been one of my favorite countries in Africa over the years, and one that I've been exceedingly bullish on. It's a large population. As you know, it's about 90 million people, and it's growing quite rapidly. It's been growing about 10% per year for the last 10 years. And GDP per capita is about expected to double in another 10 years. So even though it's starting from a low base, you really will have a large consumer class emerging and ready to buy products from all the companies we know well and global companies such as Chinese companies, Turks, Russian companies, Brazilian companies as well. So really it's been virgin ground, but there's an anticipation of a rapid growing middle class.
That's certainly true. And as you say, it's a market perhaps that's been a little overlooked despite its large size and rapid growth, partially because it still has something of a legacy of, I won't say socialist, but there's certainly they have a much more planned approach than somewhere like Kenya. Would that be correct to say?
Absolutely. They cooperate well. Ethiopians and Kenyans have been deepening their trade and business ties almost on a daily basis. What you're seeing is two exceedingly different models. On one hand, the Kenyans are very open. You have a democratic system. The new constitution makes it even more democratic in Kenya. And on the other side, you have the Ethiopian model, which is very state-centric. The federal state government, they still plan the economy. You still see a lot of Eastern model development, where you have five-year plans that are discussed, promulgated, and then executed. And the implementation side of Ethiopia governance is quite strong, while there are still criticisms on the democratic and freedom side. So it is a state-run economy, as you've said.
And that means that some sectors are closed to foreign investment, correct?
Correct. And that's been a big concern over the years, I think, from companies looking to invest in Ethiopia or funds looking to invest in Ethiopia. So, for example, the banking and the telecom sectors, because telecom has been such an exciting story across Africa, the fact that Ethiopia's telecom sectors remain government-owned has dissuaded some. And really, especially American companies, have seen the banking sector and the telecom sector is more like bellwethers for their investment plans for Ethiopia in general, which I think has been a mistake. It's really kept them out of the market for longer, while the, like I said, the Turkish companies have invested over $1.5 billion over the last 10 years in yarn manufacturing and spinning. Chinese companies have invested an enormous amount in shoe manufacturing. So it's really made American companies kind of late to the game as they continue to fixate on banking and telecom.
Okay. Now, as you said, that's the bellwether sectors which foreign investors tend to look at first. Is there any likelihood that they will open up? And if so, why would the Ethiopian government have changed its view as to keeping control of these important sectors?
I believe they will open up. It's just a matter of time. The Ethiopian government has huge public expenditure on infrastructure. They're spending about 10% of GDP every year. And in order to continue to do that, they are going to have to generate some additional funds in the future, and I think they can do that through opening banking and telecom. We're certainly not going to see it before the election, which happens next year. But post-election in the 5-year kind of range, I do think we'll see an opening of some sort in the sectors. The opening may not be complete, though. I think the Ethiopians are very good at creating their own models of development. It is a 3,000-year-old civilization, and they look at their own development history as unique in the world. And I think you could see a telecom opening that's not complete privatization or bidding, but rather some kind of licensing process that is more controlled. So we may see a middle of the road opening, but it certainly won't stay that way forever that it's closed.
And for those foreign companies that are already invested in or looking at investing in Ethiopia, what is the major negative that, as far as they're concerned, in the sectors that they can invest, like, for example, textiles or manufacturing? Is there a major concern that they expressed to you?
Yes, I think the big consumer goods firms that are looking to Ethiopia have concerns around the availability of Forex, hard currency in particular. The Ethiopian Central Bank heavily controls Forex access, and many times they've had pretty stark shortages of Forex, which gives concern to companies that would be needing to bring in inputs, that would be needing to have access to Forex to run their operations. So that's been a big concern, is the overall management of Forex. Now, companies, non-US, non-global multinationals, or Turkish companies or Chinese companies have gotten around that by using their own access to state funds. So, for example, Huajian, one of the largest shoe exporters in China, has about 2,000 workers currently on the ground in Ethiopia, Ethiopians working for factories there. And they're planning to build more and expand these shoe facilities into kind of competitive clusters, anticipating spending over about $2 billion in 10 years. But that money is in conjunction with the Chinese African Development Fund. So they're getting around some of the Forex constraints by having kind of bilateral relationships that bring in additional funding.
So of the multinationals, could you just give us a few examples of those which are either already have an exposure there or are thinking of having an exposure, having acknowledged that the concerns about getting hard currency are a major deterrent?
Sure. So we have, earlier I heard you mention about the brewers. Brewing is a big business in Africa. Beers are selling year on year, double digit growth for the companies. And one of the three biggest, Heineken in Africa, has expanded its operations in Ethiopia. So Heineken won the privatization of the three major Ethiopian breweries back in 2011. And now is expanding the facilities. So we're seeing about $150 million invested by Heineken. Additionally, Unilever is investing in manufacturing in Ethiopia, really seeing it as a competitive foothold for the emerging consumer class there. And outside of those, you have visits by Procter & Gamble, They have checked out Ethiopia several times. GE is looking and to do more in Ethiopia. So you have big companies definitely trying to find a foothold. Even KFC, which is owned by Yum Brands, is looking to open a store in Ethiopia. So, yes, many, many companies are making the preliminary efforts to enter the market, which is exciting for me and all those who really appreciate the opportunities that Ethiopia presents.
Absolutely, and it's always encouraging when you've got existing major multinationals who are putting meaningful amounts in and obviously enjoying success. So weighing up these factors, if you were an investor at the moment, is there any easy way to access Ethiopia apart from buying the multinationals like Heineken, which already have a presence on the ground? Or is it better to wait for there to be some liberalization by the government in terms of maybe partnerships in the telecom or banking area?
As you said, I think the best way to gain exposure is to invest in companies that are doing business there. And those are the kind of leading multinationals that can't afford to ignore Ethiopia. Unfortunately, the funds have yet to really expand their exposure to Ethiopia. There's only one private equity fund with full dedication to Ethiopia. But more and more private equity funds are looking at Ethiopia. So as institutional investors buy into those funds, there may be additional ways that investors can gain exposure. But currently, the best way is to kind of buy the stock of funds that are doing business there.
Okay, that makes a great deal of sense. And that's some fascinating information on a major African market, which often tends to get overlooked because, as Aubrey has been telling us, it hasn't opened up its major sectors like telecom and banking in the way other African countries have done. Thank you very much indeed, Aubrey. Hope we can have you back soon to talk about other parts of Africa that look interesting as well.
Anytime. Thank you, Gavin. Have a wonderful day.
And you. Our thanks to African consultant Aubrey Harubi for that look at the investment potential of Ethiopia. And when we come back from the break, I'll have a look at some good news for a specialist Africa fund with one of our previous guests. And we're also going to be having a look at the demographics of a major Middle Eastern market, which is being upgraded from frontier market status to emerging market status. That's Qatar. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
Are you a business innovator, or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Last week, after we'd spoken to Larry Tsirema, who's Senior Portfolio Manager at Nile Capital, he got some good news, and we have him on the line now to talk about that. Welcome back, Larry.
Thank you for having me back, Gavin.
So just after you were with us last week telling us about the launch of your new Global Frontier Fund, another one of your funds won a Lipper Award, which is the industry awards for excellent performance. What exactly happened and which fund was it?
The fund that won the award is the Nile Pan-Africa Fund for the three-year performance. And Lipper awards the best fund in the top 5 percentile that has delivered the most consistent returns. What's interesting about the award is that it is relative to peers, but also it is about consistent performance and also making sure that the performance also cares about the downside. So it is within that category that we did win the 2014 Lipper Award for Best EM Fund.
So that's not just the Best Africa Fund, Larry, just to clarify for our listeners, you won the award for the top emerging market fund out of the entire universe of emerging market funds. How many funds are there in that emerging market category?
Right. So in all emerging market funds in the U.S., in terms of mutual fund, they are 335. So we were the best fund out of that.
Well, very well done. That's a truly remarkable achievement, especially from markets that are often seen as being pretty volatile. You mentioned that the award is given for protection to the downside, and I note that the fund had a yield of around 3.5%, which was somewhat higher than the category average and the benchmark. Did that help in terms of its performance?
Yes, definitely that helps. The other interesting thing about African corporates is that they do offer high dividends because most of the corporates are still owned by families or owned by multinationals who, as a result, the corporate tends to distribute all its earnings after taxes, of course, to shareholders. So, but in addition to that, we always, because we're value investors, we're always looking for businesses that have good management of their capital allocation.
And which sectors did you have a major concentration in? I noticed a major overweight in the consumer area, which presumably has lots of these companies which have good valuation and pay decent dividends.
Consumers have been part of it. Right now, we see that sector as expensive. So our favorite sector right now is infrastructure-related companies, and that is primarily industrial companies and material-related companies like cement. They continue to be our favorite going forward because the underlying government spending on infrastructure across the entire continent is robust, and we continue to see growth in infrastructure spending. So so we can see good valuation in this group.
That's great, Larry. Well, again, many congratulations for your award, the excellent performance. We really appreciate your coming on to tell us about it. We hope to have you back soon.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Thanks so much. That was Larry Tsirema, Senior Portfolio Manager at Nile Capital in New York, talking about their Pan-Africa Fund, which has just won the award for the best performing emerging market fund out of 335 in that universe for the 3 years to the end of 2013. Now, moving from Africa over to the next continent, the Middle East, my next guest has an analysis of Qatar. This country has become more important over the last few months since MSCI announced it was upgrading it from frontier market status to emerging market status in May. Of course, Qatar is going to be hosting the Soccer World Cup in 2022, and there are major concerns being expressed about the temperature, what it's taking to build the infrastructure and the like, but that's certainly helping to contribute to its strong growth. But we're here to look at the underlying demographics of that country and seeing if, in fact, that's helping to contribute to that change. I have consultant and demographics researcher Peter Merrick on the line for a look at the country and why they matter, and why the demographics matter to investors. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, Peter.
Thank you very much, Gavin.
So it's hard to think on this chilly morning in Toronto that we're going to be looking at a country where it's probably 35 degrees centigrade at present. But that obviously is not the most congenial climate. Does that have any effect on the demographics, or is it essentially that it's the same story we've been talking about over the last few months, in that you've got a demographic dividend for this country as in the same way as you have a number of the other ones we've talked about?
It's a little different than a lot of the other countries that we've actually looked at. And the reason for that, Gavin, is most of the countries we looked at, their populations are happen to be nationals. They happen to be citizens of those countries, and that's where the growth is happening, and that's where the dividend has happened mostly. With this country, what's a little different is there's 2 million people living in it. There's 2 million people living in the Emirate, and only 250,000 of them are citizens. So most of them are workers that have actually been brought in to work on the infrastructure and to build the economy.
So that obviously is a very different situation from, as you say, some of the other countries we've looked at, which have much bigger populations, but they are all nationals, and also obviously, presumably, much lower GDP per capita, because Qatar is a pretty wealthy country by many measures.
Well, Qatar, according to the World Bank, is the wealthiest country per person. The average, if you spread out the income of the GDP, it's about $100,000 per person. So it's a very, very wealthy country. And that's why it's attracting a lot of workers who are building the economy. And the economy is flourishing because they're investing $122 billion over the next 4 years in infrastructure projects. And everybody around the world, building companies from the United States, from North America, from Europe, everyone's competing for that. And it's drawing a lot of a lot of workers from around the world are flocking there because there's really good jobs.
Yep. As you say, it's $122 billion in infrastructure, which includes the World Cup. At the same time, given that these workers are not nationals, is the government able to save on social spending? Because presumably they're not entitled to a lot of the social benefits that the wealthy Gulf countries give out to their citizens.
Yes, and that's been a problem as of lately, because the European Union has had some big issues with the way that foreign workers are actually treated when they go to Qatar. What happens traditionally is once you land in the country, your employer gets your passport, and if you become indebted or they choose not to let you go, you can lose all your rights and have no rights. And this has been a huge issue, and the EU has had committees on this and done reviews on this, and actually they've put, they've warned Qatar that they have to actually become more liberal. And they've been talking in Qatar, they've been talking about becoming more liberal, and the passports, when people actually have a visa to go there, to work there, it's not going to be sponsored by the employer. They're talking about having it directly with the government, so the government could have more control, and it'd be more liberal for the workforce who's brought in to come and leave and have that freedom, because that's been a large complaint.
Right. As you said, it certainly has been an issue, and one sees the reports of working conditions for workers who are building the infrastructure for the World Cup. And at the moment, at least the authorities, like FIFA, the governing body for soccer, are saying they are watching the situation closely and that some improvement would seem to be needed. Now, that's been the major thrust of the Qatar government, is this big infrastructure build, especially having won the World Cup in 2022. But what does the future hold for them beyond that? Because they have this very small population, 2 million, as you say, but they also have huge oil wealth How long is that likely to last in terms of reserves and number of years?
Well, some estimates show that it should last about 57 years. So here's a country that is positioned with a very small natural population of 250,000 people, has oil reserves that are amongst the largest in the world, and their natural gas reserves happen to be the third largest in the world. So it's, as long as the world is using natural resources such as oil and natural gas, their economy is suited to do really well. One of the issues that it's happening recently, which investors should be concerned, is Qatar is having some issues with its neighbors, because it has been supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood and its Al Jazeera, which is its news network that is broadcasted from there, has actually produced programs that have not been so nice, talking about the governments of Saudi Arabia, the Arab Emirates, and its other neighbors. So it's had some issues there as well. And that's having an impact. But one of the things that you've got to look at, let's turn to the demographics. Here's a very small population, which has 2 million people in it. It's investing $122 billion into infrastructure over the next 4 years. That's equivalent as the United States was to invest $3 trillion in fixing bridges and building the infrastructure over the next 4 years. That would be huge. That would actually transform the entire United States. So here's a country that's made that commitment to actually transform its entire infrastructure and its economy. And there's lots of jobs and lots of opportunity for people to invest in there. They've got a very active stock exchange where there's 42 companies listed. There's opportunity by going into a specialized emerging market fund that specializes in know which country companies are doing what, which international companies have opportunity. It's a very interesting country. But looking at the demographics, there's a very small population of their citizenship, and most of the individuals who are in the country are men who've been brought in from countries like India, Pakistan, and throughout the Arab world. It's disproportionate if you start looking from age 15 to age 64, where you're going to find the majority of, you know, the workforce. You're going to see that it's about 80% men in the country, and they've been brought in for infrastructure. And they really don't have rights. And that's always an issue, especially as an investor. You want to make sure that, you know, that you're not just making money, but you're also dealing within countries that, you know, respect human rights. And a lot of international companies and a lot of companies operating in, you know, democracies such as in Europe and also in North America, they're looking at human rights when they're trying to make a buck, because they've got shareholders and they have to justify how they're making their money.
Absolutely, Peter, and that's an important factor to consider wherever you're thinking about investing in emerging and frontier markets. Appreciate that input on the demographics of Qatar. It is, as you say, a bit of a small market, but it's also a very imbalanced one because of the import of foreign labor for the infrastructure programs. Thanks very much, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Have a great day.
And you too. Our thanks to consultant demographics researcher Peter Merrick for that look at the demographics of Qatar and why they matter to investors. We're going to break now, but before we do, in the current edition of EFMI newsletter, we check out the Emerging Markets Bond Exchange-Traded Fund as an alternative to conventional long-dated government bonds here in the developed markets. Is this a suitable investment? And if so, is it an appropriate way to invest in those types of bonds? That's one of the things that you will get from subscribing to EFMI newsletter. Please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. When we come back from the break, we'll be looking at Colombia and then finishing up with another Latin American country. Please stay with us for that.
the boardroom to you. Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing for our final segment. I'm Gavin Graham. Colombia usually ranks at or near the top of this of promising emerging or frontier markets. MSCI, the index provider, ranks it as an emerging market, but it's also included in a broader version of the frontier markets index called the Frontier Emerging Markets. Either way, there have been some interesting developments there on the political front, which include the ousting of Gustavo Petro as mayor of Bogota. I have Rupert Stebbings, who is vice president at Valores Bancolombia, on the line from Medellin to look at the impact of that event and others on Colombian equities. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Rupert.
Hi there, Gavin. Pleasure to be here.
So it's been a long battle to remove Bogota's mayor. Can you fill us in on what's been happening and what impact his ousting is likely to have on the market?
Yeah, Gustavo Petro has had a very volatile 2 years or 2 years and change as mayor of Bogota. He's now been removed, which initially spans back a period of time, but in the end, the Inspector General will hold a tremendous amount of power here. He ruled that Gustavo Petro had basically exceeded his powers. The exact case in point was to do with garbage disposal, but we don't need to go into the details. The fact was that, you know, Petro put in a left-leaning agenda. A lot of people didn't like it. He didn't make himself popular. It's a right-leaning country in general. And so at the end, after 3 or 4 months of appeals, the president last week eventually decided that, yes, he'd have to go. The Inter-American Commission for Human Rights tried to get involved in saying that, you know, the Inspector General had exceeded his powers. But in the end, the final word was the president, and the president removed him and now placed the employment minister in temporary charge for 3 months until elections in June for a new mayor.
So we're going to get a new mayor. Is it likely that he might be more business friendly? And if so, are there certain sectors that might benefit from that?
Yeah, I mean, Bogota now has elected probably the last 5 or 6 mayors, somebody left of center. So there's no guarantee we'll get somebody market friendly. Having said that, a number of the candidates, leading candidates, appear to be market friendly. And after the recent Samuel Moreno, who's the last mayor, was taken out for corruption. He's being tried still. Petro is now gone. So we may see a little more appetite to move to something more market-friendly. And with that, we should see, you know, a better atmosphere in Bogota. There's a lot of concern. Bogota directly owns EEB, ETB, some of the utility companies there. And they've had a very bumpy ride over the last couple of years as Petro's had his various pronouncements. Another company that may well benefit is Cemex Latin Holdings, which is the local arm of the Mexicans. They have most of their business in Bogota or the surrounding regions, and Petro ran a very, very restrictive construction policy. No greenfield, no brownfield, only infilling, which is very expensive for construction companies. So if we get a more market-friendly mayor who wants to, you know, spread the city out into the savannah, that will certainly help the construction sector.
Is there a good chance of that happening? Because, as you said, Bogota has generally tended to vote to the left. Is there a sufficient dissatisfaction with Mayor Petro to maybe see a more business-friendly mayor elected?
Yeah, I think it could well happen. Well, I mean, a couple of the candidates, strong candidates probably, will be the president's cousin, Francisco Santos, who's the ex-vice president. He would certainly be right-leaning. My guess is we will probably get somebody right-leaning, but you can never discount it in Bogotá. Although in the recent Senate elections, the city in general voted very heavily towards the right, so that would probably be an indication that we could well get a right-leaning candidate. Now, the other problem is obviously that Petro, although he's banned from office for 15 years, he will still be vocal, and he has already said that he will run his own candidate. So he may get a large sympathy vote, because whilst he did a fairly incompetent job as the mayor in the view of most people, he's been banned for 15 years from public office, and a lot of people think that's truly excessive. So there may be some sympathy vote for any candidate that he backs.
So just to finish up here, Rupert, we've got the upcoming presidential elections as well this year. I think it's May. Is there any direct correlation between what's happening in Bogota and what might happen in the presidential election?
It could well be. I mean, until 3 weeks ago, everyone was talking about a re-election. But Santos would basically walk home. Every poll made it very simple for him. What happened 2 weeks ago is Enrique Peñalosa, who's from the Green Party, who's been mayor of Bogota, ironically as well, he won the Green primary vote and basically immediately started to show strong in the polls. In fact, showing stronger than Santos in the second round in two or three polls. Now, it's thought that Peñalosa is from a progressive party, and it's thought that they could well look to garner Petro's support for the election. So there could be some effect. If Petro, he still maintains himself as a popular and people still want to follow him. If he moves close to Peñalosa, that could well help Peñalosa.
Okay, Rupert, thanks very much indeed for that excellent analysis of what's going on in politics in Colombia and the possible effect on the markets. We'll be back talking to you again soon, I'm sure.
A pleasure as ever, Gavin. Have a good day.
Our thanks to Rupert Stirlings in Medellin for that look at Colombian equities, politics, and the connections between the two. And now, moving further down the South American continent, the last week has not been a good one for Argentina as far as Moody's, the credit rating agency, is concerned, as it's been issuing downgrades on Argentinian banks and provinces. To talk about it, I have a regular guest, Rich Lula of the Argyle Companies, on the line from Boston. Welcome back, Rich.
Good morning, Gavin, and it's probably better to be in cold Boston or colder Toronto than balmy Buenos Aires right now.
Certainly economically, as far as that's concerned. Could you just briefly give us the highlights of the Moody's releases that were so critical of Argentina, and then going on from that, what effects they had, if any, on the stock market?
Well, the 17th of March, Moody's downgraded the government bond rating to CAA1. Stable, and then 2 days later downgraded a whole variety of Argentine banks. Generally on their financial strength was lowered, and every other credit rating that I think has been invented by capitalism was addressed. This was on the heels of a whole variety of things that have happened in this calendar year. Just looking at Bloomberg headlines, the government changed the CPI measure 34 days ago, and it's already been doubted as being accurate. It looks like inflation's running at about 28%, and the government's claiming it's lower. The government also devalued the peso right at the end of January. And there's a major court case in New York about 2001 bonds that have been defaulted on, and Argentina would like to pay on restructured bonds from the middle of that decade, and it's being blocked without making the holdouts, as they're called, whole. You would think under this circumstance you would have sort of a free fall in the stock market, and in the perverse way that investors ignore certain pieces of news. If you're a bondholder, I think it might be a little more difficult right now. But most of the stocks had no reaction whatsoever to any of those events over the last 3 months.
I'm sorry. Just to finish up here, then, as you said, the stocks didn't have any immediate reaction to all of this bad news. Is this the long-awaited buying opportunity for Argentinian stocks if you're a foreign investor?
I think you're getting very close. I think you need a little more stability to explain to your clients why you would be venturing there versus other places. But perhaps a good governor is the shares of Banco Frances, which are making new highs in local currency. Not quite so, but they're listed as an ADR in the New York Stock Exchange. And so someone in the U.S. is buying them because the stock has gone up. And knowing who those folks are might be very interesting. So I might do a little research for our next visit.
Excellent, Rich. Well, again, as you say, it's a paradox. The more you have bad news, if the market doesn't react badly to it, it may indeed be signaling that that's already reflected in prices. Thanks again for that look at the continuing crisis in Argentina, but there may be opportunity there too.
Absolutely, and we'll be at our post watching dutifully, we promise.
Excellent. That was Rich Gooder at the Argyle Companies in Boston, alerting us to possible opportunities in Argentina. So today we've covered Russia, Qatar, Colombia, Ethiopia, and Argentina. Next week we'll be back with more of our global roster of contributors for another series of reports on emerging and frontier markets. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emed. We're the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets and Frontier Markets for Dummies, which is actually out in bookstores now. We're also the publishers of the FMI newsletter that I mentioned during the program, and the latest edition is out this week. The radio program, books, and the newsletter mean we're one of the leading sources of information about emerging and frontier markets. For more information, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks, and please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.